hired in 42.
The committee would come to order, please. House Finance Committee meeting, it is Friday, April 21st, 9:20 in the morning. The one bill that we want to try and get to this morning is Senate Bill 177. We do have the prime sponsor of the bill, Senator Donnelly, here. Senator, if you'd like to come forward with your staff.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 177 is a cooperative effort between myself and the Department, Division of Insurance. We've been working together on this for a couple of years. Alaska is certainly, I think, in a minority position in that we don't allow our Director of Insurance or Division of Insurance to enforce, take any enforcement action regarding individual violations of the Unfair Claims Practices Act. It's in our statutes. States do different levels. There are tests when a director or their Division of Insurance can take enforcement action. Some states allow the director complete discretion. Some states say the director can only take action on individual single violations if it's significant. Some states use language such as it needs to be willful or significant. But in Alaska, our director can do nothing if there's a single act of a violation of the Unfair Claims Practices Act. And I think the better call for consumers in the insurance industry, I mean, in the insurance area, is clearly to empower our division director to take corrective action when there's clearly been a violation of the Unfair Claims Practices Act. And the reason for that is because, of course, insurance industry is exempt from the McCarran-Ferguson Antitrust Act. They have all kinds of unique powers. They're cost plus. We regulate their rates because of that, and we also regulate their trade practices. I think that's only fair and very important, and not being able to take action on individual violations really guts the effectiveness of the division to protect consumers. The current status is there has to be a pattern or practice, and it's very difficult to prove. And, of course, it becomes a question about whether how many instances of violations of the Act have to occur before a pattern can be proven. It's very difficult, and it's made enforcement not that great for consumers in Alaska as to individual violations. This bill, as it left the Judiciary Committee in this body, has been amended quite a few times to try to satisfy the concerns of the industry that somehow the director would treat them unfairly if they had the authority to take action regarding individual acts against consumers. We've added quite a bit of language. If you'll notice, Section 9 says the violation could not be imposed, the director could not impose a penalty unless the violation results in a loss or harm that or is intentional. Of course, the intentional standard is very difficult to prove. As you can imagine, that's actually a criminal justice standard, whether somebody intended to violate, and would virtually be impossible and would completely gut this bill pretty much if you said it has to be intentional. And remember, too, here that the division doesn't just take these actions lightly. The division exercises its discretion because it knows that its mission is clear, that it's supposed to make sure that insurance is available to Alaskans and also that insurance companies provide that insurance in a fair manner. So the division isn't just a consumer protection organization. They're also a organization that's charged with making sure that insurance is available to Alaskans. So they have a balanced approach. And any action the director may take is subject to the Administrative Procedures Act, has to go through a hearing process, it involves due process, and is also subject to appeal to the Superior Court. So directors would be loath to take unreasonable action regarding single acts because of all those due process requirements and that requirement and their balanced mission approach. The other part of this legislation that's particularly important is the redefinition of proximate cause. And this gets pretty technical, but it's very important for people in Alaska and families in Alaska And it would be very, very important to a small number of Alaskans that may suffer a loss for more than one reason. Let's take homeowner's insurance, for example. If you don't have coverage for a particular risk on your homeowner's insurance, a lot of people, there's types of risks that are they don't have coverage for on homeowners, but there's other, you know, most people have fire, but not everybody has water damage because you may live in a floodplain or something, and not everybody has landslide. Depends on where you live and what risks are specifically excluded in your policy. Well, what we thought was the rule in Alaska was that if two or more things cause a loss to your home, and you have insurance for one of them, and you don't have insurance for the other, then the question becomes, how do you deal with that problem? Well, I would suggest the better way to deal with that problem is to say, if the one you don't have insurance for is not the dominant cause, it's not the majority cause of the loss, well, then you should get insurance because you had insurance for the other one. If they're equal, you should get coverage. If the one that you don't have coverage for is not the majority cause, then you should get coverage. Now, if the one you don't have coverage for is the dominant cause of the loss, well, then you're out of luck because you didn't buy that kind of insurance. But a recent Supreme Court case said that in Alaska we're going to use a different system. We're going to say that if there's an excluded risk, even if it's not the dominant risk, even if it's just a significant cause, not the dominant cause, then you can be denied coverage based on your policy. And I would suggest that that is not a reasonable public policy. Now, that's not the best public policy in this area, and many and several other courts have. We've even had one other court, Supreme Court in the United States, specifically reject the Alaska Supreme Court's analysis in that case for several reasons. Number one, consumers don't have the opportunity to bargain with insurance companies. Insurance contracts are contracts of adhesion, is the legal term. It's a take it or leave it operation. Insurance companies write these contracts. And you walk into an insurance agent's office and say, oh, I'd like to change this word. They're not going to change that word for you. It's a take it or leave it the way their contracts are written. It's not the same as if you or I negotiate as equal parties and we negotiate over the terms of a contract. Now, I look on disfavor for limiting individual rights to contract. I believe in the rights of individuals to contract, but I also recognize, as we have in public policy and insurance and in other areas, where one party is obviously inferior in bargaining authority to the other, and there's a public policy question involved, such as we don't want a lot of destitute Alaskans because they lost their homes and had no insurance on them. When there's a public policy involved like that, you want to try to balance the playing field through regulatory action. And in this case, we regulate the contents of insurance contracts because individual parties have no bargaining authority. You don't have any bargaining power with insurance companies. So the question becomes, do we want contracts in Alaska, insurance contracts, to be able to exclude, or say that, be able to be drafted to say that, all right, you had fire insurance, but this other thing equally caused the loss to your house that you didn't have insurance on, so even though your house burned down, you're out of luck. And I would suggest that's not good public policy. I would suggest the better public policy is to say, if you didn't buy insurance for a particular risk, and that was the dominant cause of the loss, then you're out of luck. But not if it's just an equal or co-equal cause of the loss. I don't think the average consumer buying a homeowner's policy has the time and the inclination to dive into this in a way to fully understand that they're going to lose if there's... Even though their house burns down, most people just think, well, I got fire insurance, I'm okay. And they're going to be very surprised when they find out that because some other co-equal cause that you didn't have coverage for, you know, was involved in the creation of the fire, you're out of luck. I don't think that's the best public policy. Normally, I would support being able to write a contract and say, okay, if it was just two individuals, say, I'm not going to insure you for that. You know, and even if they're co-equal, as long as this one was one of the elements of the loss, you're not going to recover. I think between two people, you could do that. But when you have an insurance company, I don't think that's the appropriate public policy, and we ought to regulate those contracts. The Supreme Court in this recent case said we were going to defer, but we also lack guidance from the legislature on this. They said, well, we think it's probably, without guidance from the legislature, we're going to go ahead and allow the companies to exclude that and create that situation. So I'm here to ask that we do what the court said and give them guidance on this issue and say that the better public policy call, as other states have done, is to say that it's better to protect our consumers out there. And, Mr. Chairman, I would suggest also that the current homeowners' contracts in the state are based on the understanding that we thought we had before this case, that if it was a co-equal thing, you still had coverage if you had coverage for one of the things that caused that loss. And the director approached me, Director Lohr approached me with this problem because he was fearful that insurance companies were rewriting their policies to take advantage of this change in the law. And if we did see that, there's no impact in rates by changing this now because this kind of was the status quo 2 years ago. If we let the policies be rewritten, well, I guess we've heard some people from the insurance industry argue, well, costs will go down because we'll exclude those risks. But I would suggest to you that these kind of complicated multi-causation events are not that frequent. They may be a large amount of money because somebody may lose their family home in it. But at the same time, they're not happening a lot. And that I don't think you're going to see anywhere near a significant reduction in rates here, not to mention the fact the normal resistance to rates going down usually, although they have in some areas in the marketplace here. But the loss that's going to occur for the quality of the protection people have will be significant. And it's not necessarily significant to everybody because everybody's not going to incur that kind of loss. It's going to be in a small number of cases. But when it does occur, it's going to be very significant to Alaskan families. And I'd rather, as a public policy, give them the benefit of the doubt. If they have fire insurance and their house burns down, but there may be exceptions on that. I really don't want to get into specific examples because there may be special, like fire insurance, there may be a specific reason why there's some sort of underlying underwriting policy that doesn't include that. But there are other forms of losses that can incur in homeowners that can be multiple causes that can trigger this thing. So I think this is clearly the better public policy. Other states have adopted this. It's not going to raise rates. It may keep rates from going down slightly if they do rewrite their policies and do this, but I think it's worth that to keep this level of protection for Alaskan consumers. Thank you. Sorry.
Actually, before we get to a lot of the questions, since we've got a short time period this morning, I'd like to get to two people on teleconference in case we're likely to have to carry forward to this afternoon. First of all, I'd like to go to Bob Lohr on teleconference in Anchorage with the Division of Insurance. Mr. Lohr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Finance Committee, Senator Donnelly, I appreciate the chance to testify. I will keep my remarks very brief and mainly focus on giving you a chance to ask any questions you might have, because I know you're stressed for time. The Division fully supports Senate Bill 177. The single act authority has been extensively debated in five different hearings in three different committees during consideration of this bill. I believe that authority is appropriate for the division. In most other areas of Title 21, the insurance code, the director has authority to deal with single acts. For example, in a license violation, if an agent were into the trust fund, that obviously can be dealt with directly. In the criminal area, where there may be claimant fraud, it doesn't take a pattern or practice of violations in order to be able to refer a matter to the district attorney's office. And in that area of criminal enforcement, we've had very effective results from our staff of investigators in the section working in cooperation with the insurance industry, who refers suspected claimant fraud to us, and then we pursue investigations of those claims, and if they are fraudulent, then we refer them to the Attorney General's office or to the District Attorney's office as appropriate. I believe that's a very good model, cooperative working relationship for the division in that area, and something along those lines is needed for single act. It won't be that often that it would be used. It's not something that is going to occur every day or even every month. But upon rare occasion, a customer and a policyholder can be seriously harmed by a single unfair action of an insurance company. For example, in a recent complaint the division handled, a consumer was pre-certified for hospitalization by a health insurance company, but the insurance company unfairly delayed payment of the $186,000 hospital bill for 6 months, thereby threatening the consumer's credit rating. If Seneca 177 had been in place, the division would have been able to take action to deter future violations like that, to basically call on the company to come up with a plan to show us how that kind of violation would not reoccur, and then for the division to be able to enforce that plan. If in a situation like that where serious customer harm occurred, the insurance company was unwilling to acknowledge it or deal with fixing it, then we would consider fines as an appropriate remedy if the authority granted in Senate Bill 177 were there. I think concerning concurrent causation, we'll be happy to answer any questions. With me today is Virginia Rush, Assistant Attorney General, that handles most enforcement matters for the division. I do believe that, just to finish up on single act authority, that the division has a lot of limitations on using that authority. First of all, in Section 9, as Senator Dromney has mentioned, there's specific restrictions on the authority of the division. Secondly, the division is not going to be inclined toward excessive use of this policy because we have limited resources. We simply cannot afford to pursue single acts unless they're very serious. As Senator Dolly mentioned, there is an internal hearing officer process that is fair. Due process is available to any person accused of a violation of the act, and they get a fair hearing within the division. Ultimately, then, Superior Court reviews any action of the division for reasonableness upon appeal. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, Mr. Lohr, on the Section 9 that you mentioned, we do have a pending CS for the committee to consider that changes the word on line 14 to and. So it would be violation results in the loss or harm and is intentional. And I just wanted you to make comment on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe that that amendment would effectively eviscerate, that is, gut the single act authority for the division. I think that there are ways to provide additional limitations on the director's authority, but use of a state of mind type standard like intentional in every case has the effect of treating this almost at the highest possible standard, namely that of a criminal violation. And absent, you've all seen the movie where the bright young lawyer gets the policy manual for the company, and subsection U is deny all claims. It would take something along those lines to establish intentional wrongdoing, I believe, by a company in a single act. And I do think that that standard is much too high. If it were something along the lines of violation results in serious harm, serious loss, or is intentional, that would provide additional limitations. In addition, in Section 8, a factor for consideration of the director is whether the violation was a single act or trade practice. But I do believe adding and in line 14 would really impair the usefulness of this standard. I might give one other example. Currently, under the current Section 125 statute, the Division has adopted regulations which say that a general business practice means greater than 1% of claims mishandled within a year. And for any large company, the total number of complaints that the division handles in a year don't arise to 1% of the claims they handle, and by no means are all the complaints that we receive valid or justified. Often the company is upheld. That is simply an inapplicable standard. It doesn't have any effect at all, and I believe the use of "and" on line 14 would have roughly the same effect.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Lohr? Representative Davis?
Mr. Lohr, how has, or I could ask the bill sponsor, how has this, this section been addressed in the other committees? Has it been jumping back and forth, or has it stayed constant, or it sounds like this is one of the key areas of contention?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This section has grown more and more, stronger and stronger exception to the single act standard has gradually been added, and we're trying to pacify the insurance industry, which of course doesn't want to be responsible for single acts. Mr. Lesmeyer, the lobbyist for State Farm, has said frequently how good State Farm's record is, and in Alaska, State Farm has had a good record. But what he doesn't speak to is the record of Progressive or some of the other insurance companies who have failed to meet the target claims satisfaction rate by 3 or 4 times. So while State Farm and Allstate have done pretty well in the state, there are a lot of other insurance companies that haven't done that well. There are several others that have dismal claims records. And so while if you were only dealing with the State Farms and Allstates, you know, maybe they do only have unintentional, accidental mishandling of the claims practice. But clearly there are other people that I wouldn't give that benefit of the doubt to.
Representative Davis, is it
real quick? I mean, but on that point, even if it were unintentional, it could be a serious harm to somebody. And if they weren't willing to make it up, then you'd want to have a little bit of leverage to have that happen.
Representative Christenberg.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did we adopt a CS yet?
No.
Senator, you have looked at the CS now, and I'm concerned about Section 9.2, because when you say "and is intentionally," I think you know well that we have to look at the state of the mind of the actor. In this case, it would probably be the company or an agent, and it's very difficult to prove that a person intentionally did it. And you and I had another bill once where we dealt with the standard of knowingly and intentionally. And what is your, well, tell me how you feel about the proposed Section 9 on this, using the "and" in there, and the standards, the high standards that we'd have to get.
I think if the committee's concerned about the department or the division taking inappropriate action based on loss or harm, a better standard would be to say, to inject some modification of the loss or harm, because then at least you have an objective standard. So something like a significant loss of harm, if the committee really needs to modify this. I support the judiciary version of this, the House Judiciary version, but if the committee's will is to modify it, I would say that modifying the level of loss or harm is much preferable to adopting a criminal, you know, the highest standard, such as to have to prove intent. Because at least then the argument would become about a certainly provable thing, whether a particular loss was significant or not, to justify remedy here. So that at least you'd still be protecting those Alaskan families, or allow protection or remedial action for those families that would suffer particularly catastrophic loss because of a single incident. And the real goal here is prevention, regulation prevention. You may not always be able to help the people who had that loss, but you could issue directives to keep that particular thing from occurring again.
Representative Grusendorf.
Well, Senator, then what you're saying, we have "and is intentionally," that means that the case may be revolving around what exactly that agent was thinking, what that company was thinking, which makes it very difficult to come to a conclusion to the benefit of the person that's the claimant. In other words, it becomes a case dealing with the thought process of the company's agents.
Let's see, Representative Bundy.
I'm trying back to your earlier discussion where you had equal causes, you know, I have fire insurance but not earthquake insurance. There's an earthquake and an ensuing fire. You know, how is this played out? How does this get decided that it was a 50-50 situation or 60-40, whatever it might have been? Isn't the property owner have to going to go to court and fight this thing anyway? Is this
I'd like to defer that question.
Insurance folks aren't going to make the decision, are they?
Since I've already kind of botched up using fire as an example, which I shouldn't have used. I should have used flood or something else. But I'd like to defer that to Director Lohr, if I could, because...
Well, let's use flood. There's an earthquake, all these pipes break, and now I have flood damage, water damage. But I don't have earthquake insurance. Who makes the decision whether it's a 50-50?
Bob, do you want to try? Could you hear that question?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Bundy, I'm going to pass that question to the Attorney General's office, to Virginia Rush, Assistant Attorney General with the division, because I think it is a fairly complex legal question.
Well, it still could be a factual question to be decided in a court, which is, you know, I don't think you'd be finding 50-50. You'd be finding predominant. And if the predominant cause is covered, then under this Section 7 language, the policy would have, the insurer would have to cover the loss. If a jury or a court found that the excluded cause was the predominant cause, it still would not be covered. But this clause would reverse or invalidate policy language that says if there is an excluded cause anywhere in the chain of causation, there is no coverage. But the answer is you might still have to litigate which is the predominant cause.
Well, that gets to my point, having had some personal experience here. Unless you've got an incredibly large loss, one, you can't get an attorney to do it, two, you can't afford to do it, so you just bite the bullet and absorb your loss, because if you're going to have to go to court on these things, there's very little we can do to protect the individual consumer from a large corporation just because one has more assets than the other.
But Representative Bundy, I guess the flip side, if you the consumer has no leverage if it's just outright excluded.
But my point is that if we include it, it's still, we're not still not giving the protection we might like, because the unequal assets is still going to be a huge, I mean, that, and I'm not suggesting there's any solution for that, but I wouldn't like to think that, encourage people to think we're giving them protection that we can't.
Okay. Mr. Lohr and Ms. Rush, are you both available for this afternoon?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We do have to go. We're being called into a joint session here. So we'll set the bill aside for this time. It will be my intention to take final action on 177 this afternoon, Senate Bill 73, and also hopefully we can get through a discussion and final action on Senate Joint Resolution 40. So with that, we will recess the meeting. We'll call the chair. It is my intent that we will probably be back right along the regular afternoon schedule around 1:30.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Gene.